This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and in today's program, we will be speaking live with Professor Christine Hong of UC Santa Cruz on the military crisis in the Korean Peninsula and surrounding environments. Also, we'll be speaking with Ray McGovern, former presidential intelligence briefer as an analyst with the Central Intelligence Agency, about the significance of this week's release of documents by WikiLeaks. Also, we will commemorate the third anniversary of the WikiLeaks release of the Pentagon's snuff video called Collateral Murder. All that and more. This is 5 o'clock shadow. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we are now joined live by Ray McGovern. He is a former presidential intelligence briefer, providing the daily intelligence report for several United States presidents during his tenure as an officer of analysis with the Central Intelligence Agency. Welcome back to 5 o'clock shadow, Ray. And we wanted to talk to you today because of the significance of the work that you have done in terms of analyzing international affairs and the significance of the Special K project of WikiLeaks, who yesterday with Julian Assange and his associates announced the dissemination of 2 million State Department cables and other documents of foreign policy. First of all, what is your estimate of the importance of the WikiLeaks release?
Well, this is a very, very major event. What Julian Assange has said in characterizing this release is that their major contribution was not leaking documents that had not already been available. It was simply ordering them in a searchable way. So that if you were interested in what Henry Kissinger was doing or saying, as recorded, by the way, as recorded by the ambassadors, by the U.S. ambassadors or the U.S. reporters on the scene in these foreign countries, you get a real good look into how our policy was being conducted. For example, Kissinger is talking to the Turks and some other folks, and he kind of guffaws a little. He says, well, now, you know, with the Freedom of Information Act, I have to be careful what I say, but I can tell you that the illegal, we do immediately. The unconstitutional takes a little while longer, period, end quote. Ho, 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 ho. Okay, well, there it is. You know, maybe the State Department, when released that for a FOIA search, but there it is, hanging right out there. Was that cable already available? Yes. But you had to be a gymnast. You had to be an acrobat to go to the U.S. archives and search their database in such a way as to find it. And that's the service that WikiLeaks and Julian Assange hold up as he is in his timeshare there in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. That's what they've been able to achieve. It's quite a remarkable feat, and lots of things have come out already with respect to the wheelings and dealings of Kissinger and those like him. Things relating to Iran in particular, which of course is still on the front burner and which we've learned a lot about from the WikiLeaks cables.
The British Guardian newspaper has today, in an op-ed, one of their hacks demeaning the WikiLeaks project, which took 1.7 million, yes, archived documents, but they reverse-engineered the PDF portable document format and put them in a digitally indexed form, along with the prior cables from the WikiLeaks State Department release. And one would think that this would be a job best done by the government. But Julian Assange referred a number of times yesterday to what I thought was a brilliant phrase, that the United States government has been hiding these documents somewhere between secrecy and complexity. And on top of that, over the past several years, there has been the removal of documents from the public domain. WikiLeaks referred to some 55,000 cables that had been resecretized. What do you think about that?
That's a great word, resecretized. It's quite amazing the lengths that the Obama administration in particular, to which they have gone in trying to resecretize all this stuff. And that's why they hate Julian Assange. You know, when I was a young fellow in the Bronx, we used to watch a lot of Gene Autry. And there was one little parody on how much their Iroquois Indians hated Gene Autry. You know? They hated him yet from another picture, you know, from an earlier movie. Okay? Well, that's how much the United States hates Julian Assange. And that's why they want so much to get their hands on him. And that's why they have done a dastardly deed with respect to Bradley Manning, who has been, I think it's 1,054 days now, waiting for trial, imprisoned before trial, tortured for 8 months. They want to make an example of both of these gentlemen, lest any of the rest of us acquire secret information and make it public. The secrets are incredibly damaging. Let me give you two examples on a front burner question having to do with Iran. Everyone is always puzzled when the head of the IAEA, that's the UN
International Atomic Energy Agency.
Right, yeah. That's the one that runs the inspection regime, right? And there was a very gutsy fellow named El Baradei, a high-level Egyptian statesman, who ran that outfit before and during Iraq. And he had the guts to call the U.S. on the carpet back in just 2 weeks before the invasion of Iraq by addressing these yellow cake rumors that Iraq was seeking yellow cake uranium in deepest, darkest Africa. Now, he pressed to get the sources for that information, and the U.S. wouldn't give it to him until 2 weeks before the invasion. That was a big mistake on Bush's part, because it took El Baradei and his staff a day and a half using Google and other search mechanisms to find out that these documents were forgeries. Forgeries from the day go. They purported to show that the Iraqis were trying to get this yellow cake, which is slightly processed uranium, from Niger. Okay? And I'll never forget watching El Baradei there before the Security Council and diplomat that he was. He says, well, we have done our own research and we've consulted outside consultants on this and we have determined that these documents are unauthentic. Okay, what? They were forgeries, okay? Now, they tried to get rid of El Baradei. John Bolton and others did gymnastics to try to get rid of him, get him voted out of that position, and he was voted in yet another time. Then he retired, okay? He's back in Egypt. So who takes his place? Well, a Japanese diplomat by Amano. Now, why do I mention all this? Well, because the International Atomic Energy Agency is the one that does the inspections, and every now and then it comes back with a bizarre kind of report. Oh, we don't have any evidence that any uranium has been diverted for weapons processes, but we do have some reports that that happened. And the New York Times, Washington Post, ring changes on that theme. Iran is defeating the inspection regime. They're doing this and doing that. Now, Amano turns out, WikiLeaks cable, not only to be our man at the UN, not only to be pushed and actually nominated and with a lot of arm twisting appointed to be head of the IAEA, but guess what? As soon as he gets into office, he's asking us for money. Okay, we need a little bit more money. So, it's equivalent to a bribe. That's why this fellow is in the place that he is, and that's why it's so disconcerting when the IAEA comes up with reports that they can't substantiate. The big thing, of course, for your listeners to remember is this. We used to think that Iran was seeking a nuclear weapon. That is, we, the intelligence services. Now, in 2007, a very honest manager of intelligence came in. He headed up the State Department Intelligence Agency. His name was Tom Finger, and he came in to make sure that the intelligence agencies didn't do what they did before Iraq, and that is really screw up, intentionally screw up to, quote, justify, end quote, a war. Now, Finger set the folks to work. He said, we're going to do a bottom-up assessment. I don't care what we said in previous years. They worked all year during 2007, and at the end, November, they came to the conclusion, now listen to this, that Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon in 2003 and has not resumed work on a nuclear weapon. Now, that was a bombshell. And when that hit Congress, it was clear that it had to be released, and so Bush tried to put his best put the best interpretation on that. But you can't spin 16 U.S. intelligence agencies unanimously deciding, quote, with high confidence, end quote, that Iran has stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003 and had not resumed. Now, that has been reiterated ever since that National Intelligence Estimate of 2007, every year by the head of all these intelligence agencies, the Director of National Intelligence. It was reiterated as recently as 1 month ago. And so what am I saying here? I'm saying that all this dribble, all this tangential stuff that you see in the Washington Post, and particularly the New York Times, is structured in such a way to mislead the American people into thinking that Iran is a major threat. And unfortunately, according to the recent polls, not 60%, not 70%, as was the case before Iraq, but 90% and more, American people believe that the most dangerous nation out there for the United States is Iran. So the propaganda is working well, and yet when you look at what the agency, the intelligence agency, is saying, it's the same as we've been saying since 2007. What I want to do is just refer to a specific issue of the New York Times. This is the issue of Monday, November 29, 2010. Now, this was important because this was right after a major WikiLeaks disclosure of some 250,000 State Department cables. Okay? Now, the Times had several weeks to pore through these cables, okay, and decide what was worth the reporting. And guess what they decided to report on? Well, the danger from Iran. First page, a cable reveals for the first time. The United States believes that Iran obtained advanced missiles from North Korea. Whoa. Let's get in there. Okay, we turn it to the inside pages, and we got page 8 and 9 and 9 and 10, all devoted to the specter of Iran. I won't wear out your patience here. I'll just point one major gaffe, and that is on page A8, there's a very menacing picture of advanced missiles mounted on trucks in North Korea. And the caption reads, Iran has bought 19 advanced missiles from North Korea, according to a February 24, 2010 diplomatic cable by WikiLeaks. In a parade in October, North Korea displayed what some experts said appeared to be the same kind of missiles as the 19 advanced missiles Iran bought from North Korea. Headline of the item, Iran fortifies its arsenal with the aid of North Korea. Now you have to read into the fine print on the next page here, and you find out that the Russians, who were supposed to have designed this missile, said to us in the same cable, in the same WikiLeaks release cable, how do you know about this missile? Does this missile exist? We have not seen it. It's certainly not been tested. You agree that it's not been tested. Do you think Iranians are so dumb that they buy 19 of these things that don't exist and have not been tested in the U.S.? And the U.S. Negotiators said, well, we know it's not been tested and we're not sure about it, but we think that the Iranians might want to buy it for spare parts. It's so the point is this. This menacing photo with these North Korean missiles, which the Times says definitively, 19 of which have been given to Iran, sold to Iran, And it cites a U.S. diplomatic cable, which was released by WikiLeaks. It's the 24th February 2010, but it doesn't tell the full story. The full story says that the Russians left us to scorn. They said it's supposed to be a Russian model. You know, we always test our models, by the way. And how do you account for the fact that it's not been tested or we've never seen it?
Ray, we don't have the Times, so to speak, for the full story. We don't have the New York Times for the full story, as you've clearly pointed out. But this brings us to my ultimate question for you. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacific Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we're speaking with Ray McGovern. He was the featured speaker recently in London at the Sam Adams Intelligence Awards, and he is a former presidential daily intelligence briefer. During his tenure as an officer with the Central Intelligence Agency in the analytic department of the company or the shop. And Ray, here is why I so very much wanted to speak with you today. One of the points brought out in the WikiLeaks press conference on the Plus D Public Library on U.S. diplomacy is that there was, they claimed, a tendency for diplomats and foreign service officers, intelligence agents, and others to sometimes underclassify their memoranda, cables, or reports because of the burden of going through the more rigorous diplomatic pouch protocols. And as a result, I think the intimation was made, the content of these cables became much more interesting because of the more convenient way to transmit and share sensitive information. Here's the question, Ray. During your service as a presidential daily intelligence briefer, did you have comparable tools as we are seeing come out by WikiLeaks? And would your work have been made easier or different? How do you contrast the inside way intelligence is gathered globally from agents around the world and the ease of use that WikiLeaks is now sharing with citizens at large?
Well, Robert, let me betray a trade secret here. This is not to go out of this room, okay? when I was working at the CIA for 27 years, we depended for our information on open media sources for about 80%, that's 80% of the information we needed to make cogent judgments on what was going on abroad. Now, there are exceptions to that, but that was the general rule, okay? Now I'm told that 90% of what people depend on is available, and available in a quick way that was never possible for us back in the old days, okay? So when this treasure trove of documents is out there, and it is a treasure trove, for everyone to see, people will see what our diplomacy has been like. Now, it's very important to stress that of the original 250,000 diplomatic cables, they were low-level classification, and yet they were still a gold mine. Most of them were at the confidential level. Some were unclassified. Some were, the very small segment was secret. But what we haven't gotten are the top secret, or the code word, or the communications of very secret agencies, and you can imagine who they are. So even with this unclassified or confidential trove, which amounts to about 90% of these cables, insight can be gotten as to how we were twisting this arm or that, how we were persuading people to facilitate the delivery of our prisoners to black sites for torture. It's a gold mine, and the only thing is that Julian Assange has taken this next step of getting 1.7 million records, ordering them in a way where if people are really interested in knowing what's going on, they can find out what's going on, not from the malnourishment they get from the major media, but immediately. They can just download the cables, they can look by category, and they can see what U.S. foreign policy has been for the last decade or so. That's an incredible service to us all. In this case, no one can really accuse Julian Assange of anything other than ordering these things in such a way that people don't have to jump through hoops to get them out of the National Archives. It's a wonderful service. I applaud him for it.
My perspective is that he and WikiLeaks and their team, with their technical genius, are doing exactly the job that the State Department, the National Archives, the U.S. Information Agency, and others should be doing in order to make information more freely accessible as specified by law.
Yeah, actually, I think you're right there, Robert, but I fault first and foremost the domesticated media. We no longer have in this country a fourth estate. The only salvation is the fifth estate, which happens to be in the ether. It's called the internet, the web. And without that, people would be really malnourished to starvation on finding out what was really going on.
We're speaking with Ray McGovern. And Ray, we've covered the issue of Bradley Manning. You referred to that. In a short while, we'll be speaking with Professor Christine Hong about the developments on the Korean Peninsula. But I give you the last word here now about the various processes that seem to be tending towards freedom of information contrary to the will of the government. Are you optimistic about citizens' ability now to be more informed and intelligent? And how do we protect that flow of information and those who make it possible, with a specific reference to Bradley Manning, WikiLeaks, and what other institutions you think might be doing that, including yourselves?
Well, I think that we have a golden opportunity right now to stand up to what's been happening, to our ability to find out what's going on in this world. Bradley Manning has been denied his constitutional right of a speedy trial. He's been accused of the commander-in-chief of this army of having committed a crime. Talk about command influence. And he's going to start his actual trial after 3 years at Fort Meade, Maryland, on the 3rd of June. There's going to be a big demonstration on the 1st. I will be one of the speakers there. I think we need to say, look, this Bradley Manning is responsible for so much information that we needed to have to realize what's going on, that he should be applauded and not jailed. As for Julian Assange, I'm ashamed. I'm ashamed that the U.S. was able to twist the arms of those Swedish women and the Swedish judicial process and make it so that if Julian Assange steps out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London, he is in danger of being picked up by the London police, carried off to Heathrow and swiftly to Sweden for a day or two and off to the United States. What will happen to him? Well, we all know that there's been a secret grand jury impaneled and that one of the emails that has been divulged indicates that Julian Assange is, quote, enemy number one, end quote, of the United States government. Why? Because he's really stole these things, because he's made it easy for historians, for journalists, for those of us who don't trust either in these days, to find out what's going on with respect to Afghanistan, Pakistan, torture, Iran, first and foremost, now since it's on the front burner again. The service that has been provided by a young man of 22 years, Bradley Manning, who thought that he couldn't watch torture, he couldn't watch the obliteration of those 12 people in the collateral murder video without doing something about it. And so he did something about it. His superiors refused to do something, and so he did. And Julian Assange was there to put it out for the rest of the world. Now, if you want to see how war brutalizes people, and I don't mean only those 12 Iraqis that were brutalized by being killed by the helicopter gunship, but just listen to the conversations of our soldiers in that gunship. It's bloodlust.
Our listeners shall have a chance to do exactly that later in today's program. And I want to thank you for your continuing work on bringing about mass public consciousness or intelligence, as it were. Ray McGovern, you have a website, raymcgovern.com, is it?
That's right, Robert.
And you write frequently for Consortium News Service. Well, thank you. It's always a revelation to have you on 5 o'clock, Shadow Ray, and we'll continue following this story as events develop. Thank you once again.
Most welcome.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we continue our survey of world affairs today by now taking a look at the Korean Peninsula, where there are military, economic, political, and diplomatic difficulties in regard to just who shall have domain over the region. Over the past week, we spoke with Hyun Lee of Asia-Pacific Forum about breaking developments, and now, as we continue watching the situation in Southeast Asia, there are several developments. The United States Pentagon officials have said that they're developing a strategy for what they call a measured countermeasure to respond tit for tat, as it were, for any actions that might be taken by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea government based in Pyongyang. The question of proportionality in that retaliation or reaction in the event of untoward developments remains completely unclear. In addition, there are reports that there may have been secret communications between Washington and Pyongyang, as the the mainstream media is putting forward what they purport to be the threatening story of a possible missile move or test launch. The adrenaline and tension and danger continues to rise daily. We're so very glad to be joined now by Christine Hong, professor at the University of California at Santa Cruz and co-author with Hyun Lee of Lurching Towards War, A Postmortem on Strategic Patience. Welcome to 5 o'clock Shadow, Christine. Where do you think the crisis is today?
I think the crisis is, I don't think we can rest assured that the crisis is anywhere near over, but I think that there have been a number of reassuring signs of potential policy cleavages within the Obama administration. And so what we witnessed last week, and I think these are very salutary developments, are, as of last Thursday, the Wall Street Journal reported that the Pentagon was going to suspend what Washington was calling its playbook vis-a-vis North Korea. And apparently what this playbook entails are a series of spectacular displays of U.S. military might, sometimes in combination or collaboration with South Korea. That are meant to broadcast to North Korea that it could be exterminated at any moment. But, of course, the other audience for this is also China. These kinds of regional displays in very closely connected geographic territories are never meant simply for the intended receiver. But we can question who the intended receiver actually is. But so what happened was the Pentagon indicated that it was going to dial back its playbook. Why? Because it couldn't risk North Korean, quote-unquote, misperception. And so this goes back to something that Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel said in response to a question by a journalist who queried whether or not the U.S. flying of B-2 bombers and announcing it for the world to know over the Korean Peninsula and dropping dummy munitions in a simulated first nuclear strike against North Korea, whether or not that was provocative. And Chuck Hagel's response, which was dutifully reported by the press, was, no, these actions by the United States are not provocative. And I think that what we have, recently, including the suspension of a military test on the part of the United States recently, that's more recent news, is a kind of dialing back. And they say it's because they can't risk North Korean misperception, but I think it's quite clear that the U.S. is tacitly acknowledging that its own actions are provocative. And if I can mention just one other thing, there's also really interesting coverage in some of the global press of the fact that China was amassing its forces along the North Korean border, and that China, too, had conducted a live fire drill, a set of live fire drills in the West Sea. And this, of course, was happening at the same time that the U.S. was conducting massive, proportionately much larger war exercises with its ally, South Korea. So there's that as well. And I think that although the United States never did directly address China's own escalated military presence, I think that that might have been something that U.S. policymakers didn't fully account for.
We're speaking with Professor Christine Hong of the University of California at Santa Cruz. And Christine, one of the things that is so often reported in the American mainstream media is the existence of some number of nuclear devices by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. But I'm wondering if you could give us a bigger context in regard to what other nuclear weapons are there in the region. Are there nuclear weapons on aircraft carriers of the United States? Have nuclear weapons ported in Japan or in South Korea? What is the other side of the nuclear equation there?
I mean, the other side of the nuclear equation is always that which must be disavowed and never mentioned, which is the fact that the United States remains the world's largest nuclear power, and it dwarfs every single other country in the world in terms of its own arsenal and its own nuclear strike capability. And so if you look at the long history of U.S. relations within, or U.S. policy within the Asia-Pacific region, you know, there are historians who describe the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki not simply as the last act of World War II, but the first act of the Cold War. By bombing these two civilian sites, the United States was again putting on a theatrical demonstration, not really for the Japanese people. Japan was effectively defeated by this point. There was no military justification for these displays, but the intended audience in that instance was the Soviet Union. And the United States was, in effect, declaring that it would set the regional terms of the post-war peace so that it would advantage the United States. And so if you think about the history of the region, the first user and the only first user has been the United States. And, you know, in terms of the Korean War, you know, the U.S. contemplated a nuclear strike. Throughout North Korea's history, the United States has threatened North Korea 9 times with a nuclear strike. And this goes up until George W. Bush's office. And so, you know, we have a series of threatened nuclear strikes. And then in the you know, after the signing of the Armistice Agreement in 1953, the U.S. stationed nuclear weapons in South Korea up until the 1990s. And this was in direct violation and contravention of the terms of the Armistice Agreement. And so, you know, when you think about the fact that North Korea has, yes, as everyone knows, conducted 3 nuclear tests, we have to realize that the United States has conducted well over 1,000. And when it comes to, you know, these claims that North Korea has to denuclearize, the U.S. has always arrogated to itself the right of having a nuclear first strike against North Korea. So we can, you know, one thing that's not off the table is that in order to denuclearize North Korea, the U.S. might conduct a nuclear first strike. This has always been an option that it's held open for itself. And, you know, as you mentioned, I mean, there is, in this kind of discussion of North Korea's denuclearization, no self-reflexive concessions on the part of the United States toward non-proliferation, toward a reduction of its own military might. Instead, what we see in recent history is a series of regime change interventions that the U.S. has conducted. North Korea routinely mentions Iraq, Libya, and Syria as possible scenarios that await it at the hands of the United States.
Christine Hong, I really am impressed by your analysis today. And I know that you are preparing for your next class, and we appreciate your urgent time with us. Hence, this is my ultimate question to you. One of the important things that was said in the WikiLeaks press conference for the Public Library on United States Diplomacy yesterday is that we see a pattern where crises are escalated, amplified, exaggerated. And the result of doing that is that there is constantly a funds transfer, as Julian Assange put it, a funds transfer from the taxpayer to the military-industrial complex, the makers of missiles and rifles and defense systems and aggressive systems. Can you speak to how the ramping up of this military crisis in the peninsula has led to the economic, the political, the governance, and in particular, the humanitarian tragedies in the north and perhaps throughout the region?
You know, there's so many things that I could say in response to that really thoughtful and excellent question. And, you know, I guess the first thing that I would say is that you know, Bruce Cummings, the historian at the University of Chicago, states quite plainly that it is with the Korean War that the military-industrial complex is consolidated. It is with the Korean War that the national security state is established. And, you know, there was a historian or a journalist of his day, I.F. Stone, who in the Hidden History of the Korean War questioned, why is this war necessary? And why are there these different generals, American generals, who have come out and said, Korea came along and saved us? So if we think about World War II as engendering a total war economy, I never think of Rosie the Riveter as a feminist icon. I think of her as a total war icon. And when you think about World War II as a total war with U.S. industry geared, domestic industry geared toward military production, well, my goodness, the Korean War did come around and save the United States. And so I think that it's very interesting that there are these, you know, ridiculous films that everyone always laughs at. They're B-films at best, films like the remake of Red Dawn, which in the post-production phase entailed the, because of political sensitivities, the replacement or substitution of the Chinese communist villain with the evil North Koreans. And so, you know, this film recently came out and people poo-pooed it as a kind of trotting out of an anachronistic Cold War enemy, North Korea. But in point of fact, this film and other films like it that, you know, depict North Korea as this kind of resistant evil that has, you know, outlived its own sort of time, these kinds of films actually betray a larger truth, which is that when it comes to the military-industrial complex, every single defense budget increase, every single justification for the funding of a new weapons system, every single justification for the expansion of the United States in this contemporary moment to the Asia-Pacific region uses North Korea as a very convenient pretext.
Thank you so much for breathtaking clarity on the issues of war, peace, and the Korean Peninsula. Christine Hong, where can people follow your work?
You know, I'm affiliated with the Korea Policy Institute, and so that is one website that I would encourage your listeners to check out. It's kpolicy.org.
Well, thank you, and have an equally brilliant class as you've shared with our listeners here today on 5 O'Clock Shadow.
Great. Thank you so much.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. Christine Hong is a professor at the University of California at Santa Cruz. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And we today commemorate the fact that it was 3 years ago this week that WikiLeaks released a horrifying example of the routine war-making policies of the United States in Iraq and elsewhere, and in particular including the now exponentially increased use of drones and electronic visual feedback by the Obama administration, whether in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Somalia, Yemen, or elsewhere around the world and soon to be done domestically. The video, which is a military recording of the visuals of the gunship helicopters and the audio to the command center, it was called by WikiLeaks collateral murder, and it depicts, or the murder by United States military forces of journalists, children, and civilians during a misguided fit of frenzy that became inhumanely brutal in its execution. So today on 5 O'Clock Shadow, we commemorate the publication by WikiLeaks of Collateral Murder by way of this portion of a documentary from our colleagues at Panorama.
A neighborhood in Baghdad, July 2007. Shots are fired from the air, fired from an American Apache helicopter. Minutes later, U.S. infantry soldier Ethan McCord arrives at the scene.
When I came up onto that scene, I remember thinking, you know, oh, well, this guy with the RPG or this guy with the AK-47 obviously did this to the van. There's no way in hell that we would do this.
This military video shocked the world when WikiLeaks released it, and this man is being blamed for illegally downloading it from a secured army network. 23-year-old Bradley Manning, who has been held in solitary confinement for 7 months. A small group of supporters is demanding his release, but their voices are drowned out by media that has largely presumed his guilt.
I'm sorry, that's treason. So there's no gray area about it. And so that is a capital offense.
You capital can't offense, have so you're saying execution. You're saying execution.
If he is convicted of treason, I absolutely would support a capital punishment.
Oh, shut down WikiLeaks. Get a presidential order to shut that down. This guy should be tried. Manning should be tried for treason. Execute him if he's found guilty.
Whoever in our government leaked that information is guilty of treason. And I think anything less than execution is too kind a penalty.
The onboard camera of this attack helicopter is targeting a group of people in a neighborhood in Baghdad. Among them are two journalists from the news agency Reuters. The photographer Nami Nu Eldin and his assistant Said Hamiga. The men can neither see nor hear the helicopter that is stalking them. It is too far away. The pilots mistake Nur Eldin's camera for a weapon.
Hotel 26 is Crazy Horse 18. Have individuals with weapons.
And attack them.
Let me know when you gather.
What you? Light them all up.
Come on, fire!
Scenes that resemble a video game, but what you see here is real. Real people. The pilots are laughing, making macabre jokes.
God damn it, Kyle.
Sorry.
The Apache gunner is still targeting the heavily wounded Reuters employee Saad Hamiga. He will not survive. Later, the Pentagon investigates the incident and concludes that Sherpa pilots had done nothing wrong. The attack was part of a combat operation. It was justified because earlier American soldiers had come under fire by insurgents. The Pentagon has denied our request for an interview. However, one individual has been punished, Bradley Manning, in jail accused of leaking the video. The charges, downloading and disseminating classified information. His roots lie in Europe. As a teenager, he moved to Great Britain, to the small town Haverford West. His mother is British, his father American. Here, he attended school for 4 years and graduated with Tom Dyer. He was one of Manning's closest friends. To Dyer, it is no surprise that Manning might have released the video. He remembers his friend as a great idealist, even when he was still a teenager.
He had a great moral compass. He knew in himself what was wrong and what was right, and he didn't like the thought of people abusing their status and making other people feel small and doing things that were wrong.
It was precisely for this reason that Manning joined the army. He said he wanted to fight for the good, but during the Iraq War he apparently started to have doubts. As an intelligence analyst, he had access to secret military files, including the video with the disturbing scenes. The video shows how Reuters employee Said Hamiga is struggling for his life. He survived the first shots fired from the attack helicopter. The pilots are still keeping track of him. Meanwhile, Saleh Matasha Tumal and his two small children, Sayad and Duaha, are on their way to school. From his van, he sees the wounded Reuters employee lying on the curb. Tumal stops the car, gets out to help him. His two little children remain in the front of the van. The pilots request permission to shoot, again and again.
Roger. Break. Crazy Horse 1-8, request permission to engage. I'm picking up the wounded. See how we're trying to get permission to engage. Come on, let us shoot.
The father is unaware of all of this. He does not even notice the helicopter above him. Tumal wants to rush the wounded Reuters employee to a hospital. His compassion will seal his fate.
1-8, gate, clear.
Come on.
Clear. Clear. Orange.
Even when the soldiers realize that they have shot children, they only hesitate for a moment, then make cynical remarks from the air.
Oh, it's their fault for bringing their kids to a battle.
That's right.
Since that day, U.S. Army soldier Ethan McCord has been heavily traumatized. He still cannot get the images out of his head. As an Army infantryman, he was one of the first soldiers on the scene. When he arrives at the van, he hears the 5-year-old girl scream.
So I grabbed the girl and I took her into the house behind the van with a medic, and we were cleaning her up. And what I did is I took my gloves off and was pulling glass out of her eyes so that she can blink without cutting her eyes.
Then McCord runs back to the van to check on the boy. The child is still alive but badly injured. He carries the boy back to the medics as well. As his superiors observe this, they vehemently order him to stop saving the children. Instead, he should do his job and secure the area they command.
Another thing that bothered me was the fact that I was the only one to care enough, it seemed, for the children to try to ensure that they get medical attention.
Former Army officer Ray McGovern is shocked by the actions of the pilots. He had been a CIA analyst for 27 years and an advisor to 7 presidents, including George Bush Sr.
How could anyone justify shooting up that van, shooting up the person who was crawling onto the curb? These are war crimes, pure and simple. When I learned to be a soldier, an officer in the U.S. Army, I learned that you don't shoot at civilians. You certainly don't shoot at people trying to rescue the wounded, and you don't blow up vans with a couple of children in them.
In the Pentagon investigation report, there's no mention of war crimes. The pilots had reacted adequately.
Here's the government saying that we did no wrong, but yet they lied. They covered up the story. They covered up everything. And then all of a sudden being like, okay, well, Bradley Manning, who released this video, he's the wrongdoer in this whole situation. It's kind of like, well, we have to have a guinea pig, a fall guy.
Meanwhile, Bradley Manning is isolated. His rent David House is one of the few supporting him, and besides his lawyer, the only person currently visiting Manning in prison.
He's held for 23 hours a day in solitary confinement in his cell. His cell has no windows, and he's not allowed to go outside or see the outdoors. He's not allowed to exercise. The 1 hour a day he is allowed out of his cell, he's allowed to walk in chains in an empty room for an hour. And that was what the military calls exercise in this case.
Conditions that resemble torture. For 7 months, Bradley Manning has been kept in the maximum security ward of the military prison in Quantico. Still without trial. The Pentagon regards the prison conditions as perfectly fine, and conservative military experts also think they are appropriate.
Well, first of all, you have to define solitary confinement, you know, which is a very broad and open-ended term as what that means. Does it mean sensory? Does it mean sensory deprivation, which some people consider torture? I don't think he's suffering sensory deprivation. So, as long as somebody's allowed to have 4 hours of continuous sleep, the body can function just fine.
The United Nations, however, has a different view. The UN has picked up the case and is examining the accusations of torture.
because solitary confinement has been shown to produce the kind of severe mental and psychological harm that is associated with the definition of torture, or if less severe, still associated with cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or punishment.
That doesn't mean that your personal comfort and interests come ahead of the U.S. government. Somebody's been accused of a crime, and they're being detained under the conditions which are appropriate for them. That's the way every legal judicial system in the entire Western world works.
Prison without trial for Bradley Manning, freedom for the Apache pilots. Former U.S. soldier Ethan McCourt finds this incomprehensible. He's pleased the video has been leaked so that the public can form its own opinion.
I think that Bradley Manning is a hero. I believe that this is a human being who is compassionate, who saw illegal activities taking place on a video. Granted, it was a couple years later, but still wanted the world to see that these actions are intolerable. And, you know, yeah, he's a hero for showing it. He's a hero for releasing it. If he released him.
My view on Bradley Manning is that he's a very courageous young man who, with 22 years, did what I didn't have the guts to do during the Vietnam War.
For 7 years, Ethan McCourt had fought proudly for his country. Today, he feels ashamed.
I didn't pull the triggers that day. I didn't shoot people. I didn't shoot those people on the ground. But it's me being a part of the system that is doing that to the people of Iraq is disgusting, and it hurts. And it was really hard for me to justify being in Iraq and being a soldier. And I would never be a soldier again. For the American government, it's too dirty.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow, and that, an exegesis of Collateral Murder in Baghdad by United States military forces, courtesy of Panorama, and with thanks to WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, Ray McGovern, and Private First Class Bradley Manning, and other whistleblowers and truth seekers, including our listeners. And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow, the program engineered by Michael G. Haskins and Reggie Johnson. We welcome your comments, leads, tips, leaks, or suggestions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.